It is ecstasy and bliss that speak to us most totally of what love's mercy really is, how boundless it is, how totally forgiving it is, how utterly concerned with our meager self-absorption and self-hatred it is, and how always crazily, incessantly open to us it is at every single moment. And this is why the great Sufi mystics again and again and again, although they don't say that ecstasy is the only way, invoke this ecstasy of the heart so that it can teach us where we really are at home, which is in the bliss of divine love. Poor cupbearer, the wine of the invisible, the name and sign of what has no sign. Pour it abundantly, you who enrich the soul. Make the soul drunk and give it wings. Come again, always fresh one, and teach all our cupbearers their sacred art. Be a spring jetting from a heart of stone. Break the pitcher of soul and body. Make joyful all lovers of wine. Ferment a restlessness in the heart of the one who thinks only of bread. Bread's a mason of the body's prison, and wine is a rain for the garden of the soul. I've tied the ends of the earth together. Lift now, cupbearer, the lid of the jar of heaven. Close those eyes that see only faults. Open those that contemplate the invisible. So no mosques or temples or idols or sects or dogmas remain. So this or that is drowned in his fire. And if I have another prayer for this meeting, is that that fire comes down to each one of us and does what Rumi describes in one of his greatest poems, reaches into the depths of our chest and rips open that chest so that the hidden volcano of passionate love for the divine can answer in its burning lava, that burning lava of rapturous and passionate love that is always being sent towards us. And in the name of that prayer, I would like to read you a great poem about love coming to shatter and rebirth. If destiny comes to meet you, love will come to meet you. A life without love isn't a life, and God does not take it into account. Every second that unravels far from love is a source of shame before the Lord. And when you leave this house at last, you will only be able to carry what weighs nothing. Time that reveals itself will reveal that the time passes, that passes in the torment of love, is really the patience, the tender patience of a father. And time will reveal that the poverty that you are ashamed of now will be for you an honor in the other world. And time will reveal that although the bitterness of patience is suffocating to you now, it will, in the end, become a wonder of joy. When the lion of the spirit escapes his cage, he will run towards the fields of splendor. And when he descends from this donkey's carcass, the king of the heart will be a king of rapture. Only spread out the hem of the robe of effort. A rain of gold will pour from heaven. Whoever doesn't show himself humble today will tomorrow be humiliated like Pharaoh. And whoever isn't transformed like the rose into rose water will be cast like thorns into And if there's a third prayer I would like to give for our meeting, it would be that you really heard Llewellyn when he said, put away your notebooks, stop learning, unlearn. But that you also heard what Rumi is saying when he says, only spread out the hem of the robe of effort, a rain of gold will pour from heaven. And know that there's an enormous difference between trying to absorb something as learning with the mind and doing the great, wild, deep heart work that is the real effort of the path. That work of constantly stretching the heart so that it can remain open, 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 open. A marvelous wild Sufi in Paris told me that the whole meaning of the Sufi path was in this. He said, at the beginning, you start with a narrow, self-absorbed, self-obsessed little heart that is scrunched up like this fist. And then, because God is very, very good, God sends you a bliss or two that gets you here, and you freeze that immediately. You say, this must be total awakening. So you're in line now for a great suffering, and that comes, and that breaks your heart here, and you freeze there, and then there's a great bliss, and then there's a great suffering, and then there's a suffering, and then there's a bliss, and then there's a revelation, and then there's an emptiness, and then there's immense, immense longing, and then one day happens when the whole of your being has been opened in this vast yes to the divine. And when you have reached that yes that is reached on the cross and is the yes that turns crucifixion into resurrection, when you have reached and become that yes, you are then, of course, for the rest of your life put into humble slavery to love, to do the work of love. And in honor of that force of love that takes us to that yes, what will take you to that yes? There is one thing and one thing only that will take you to that yes. Ramakrishna, who's an honorary Sufi, said something wonderful. He was always being told that he was too much. And he was a sweet and humble man, and he was in ecstasy a lot. And one day, a very severe sort of Brahmin came in and said, Swami Ramakrishna, you are a lot too much. And he said, dear Brahmin, you are not enough. But he also said, which is very, it's a wonderful line for Sufis to remember when their excesses are being checked by those who can't stand those who are alight with joy and love. There's another wonderful remark, perhaps more serious, that this honorary Sufi Ramakrishna said. He said, knowledge will take you to the courtyard of love, but love will take you into the bedchamber. And of course, the distinction between knowledge and love is a purely mental one, because the more you love, the more you know. The more you know, the more you love. They feed each other. But make no mistake, on this path of the explosion of the heart, of the becoming of the eternal yes, it is the force of supreme divine passion in the heart that will take you through everything that you have to be taken through until that yes is printed in letters of eternal fire in every cell of your being. And so in honor of that force, I'd like to read you my favorite poem of Rumi, which I have on my fridge, which has the following title. Look for passion, 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 passion. And I want to say one thing about why I think this conference is so important. Because I don't know if you've noticed, but we're living in a fabulously passionless age. And I don't know if you've also noticed, but there is an incredible dearth of passion in the so-called New Age, which often seems as new to me as last week's leftovers. What makes us new and perpetually fresh and truly alive is sacred passion. And what the Sufis, above all other mystics, I think, have to give to the world is the amazing technology of how to keep this passion alive and focused and clear and dedicated to its true purpose, which is to be drowned in the beloved and then to serve the beloved in all things. And this poem is really the key to why this passion is at the key of the path. And before I read it, I'd like to say something about passion. Don't think that passion is emotion. Don't think that passion is raising your voice and being dramatic like Andrew Harvey. This is just now. Passion is the commitment to orient your whole being toward God at all moments. A great French mind, Marcel Marceau, said, passion is a long patience. The really passionate are those who develop the stamina to stay in the furnace of love so that it can smelt them into gold. And that is a passion beyond anything emotional. It is the total dedication of the inmost part of the heart to the divine. And that is the passion, of course, that Rumi is talking about. All other passions are mere shadows of that immense, silent, patient passion. Passion burns down every branch of exhaustion. Passion is the supreme elixir and renews all things. No one can grow exhausted when passion is born. Don't sigh heavily, your brow bleak with boredom. Look for passion, 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 passion. Futile solutions will deceive the force of passion. They're bandits who extort money through lies. Marshy and stagnant water is no cure for thirst, however limpid and delicious it might look. It will only trap you and stop you looking for fresh rivers that could feed and make flourish 100 gardens, just as each piece of false gold will prevent you from recognizing real gold and where to find it. False gold can only cut your feet and bind your wings, saying, I will remove your difficulties, when in fact it is only dregs and defeat in the robes of victory. So run, my friends, run far away from all false solutions and let divine passion triumph and rebirth you in yourself. This immense volcano of love is charging towards us at every moment, waiting for one tiny aperture of open in us to inundate it with its lava. At a certain moment in the path, you know that there is nothing more important to do than to take your heart and to stretch it as far as you can so as much of that molten passion can come and live forever in it and open the deep sources of your own molten passion. And when you get to that stage and when you let that passion invade you, then slowly the great rebirth, the great birth into divine consciousness can go as smoothly and clearly as possible. And the whole secret is to try and get to that place as fast as you possibly can. Now for some fun. I think we need it. One of the things that all people discover as they open to passion and to the passion of the path is that fire, in the divine sense, has two aspects. It has a very tender aspect, a burning, a blissful aspect, and it has also a wrathful and searing aspect, because when you enter into the flame of passion, you are like a log that's been fetched from the depths of a dank forest, and when you put a log into the fire, it splutters and spatters. And here's a marvelous poem of Rumi that will encourage you when the spluttering and spattering starts, and it'll go on, believe me, in different forms for the rest of the path. There's always something to be refined. And this is called The Housewife and the Chickpea. Look at the chickpea in the pot, how it jumps when it's put into the fire. When you boil the water it's in, the chickpea leaps to the top of the pot and cries out, why are you burning me? Wasn't it enough to buy me? Do you also have to afflict me? But the housewife continues to push it down with her spoon. Be still and boil well. Don't jump far from the one who makes the fire. I don't boil you because I hate you. I boil you so you and the choir taste and savor, and so you can become food and mingle with life. Your affliction doesn't come from being despised. When you were fresh and green, you drank water in the garden. You drank water then so that you could prepare for this fire. The mercy of God precedes his testing. His mercy has always preceded his anger, so you can obtain life's authentic wealth. Chickpeas, you boil in trials and sufferings, so neither self nor existence may remain in you. Become food, become strength, become fine thoughts. You were weak as milk. Become jungle lions. I know that we will all come to moments when we will be those chickpeas at the top of the pot begging for the fire to be taken away from the water. But it's always amazingly helpful to remember that the cook who's doing it knows exactly the flavor they are trying to extract. And now, let me just read you three poems about the last stages of the path, in which the power and beauty and bliss of all of the names of God become normal conscious experiences, always amazing and always deepening and always expanding, but indisputably there. You see, what the Sufi mystics and Sufi poets are telling us is that this tremendous adventure into the truest meaning of Al-Halaj's and Al-Haq is an adventure that you and I take here in time in this body. It's not an adventure we have to wait for some other world to experience. And one of the most wonderful things about reading Rumi is that reading Rumi will remind you of who you are and of where you are going, and of what amazing recognitions and revelations and raptures await you normally when you have done the work and when you have let grace transform you. And in honor of these great flowering that will happen in each one of your hearts and minds and bodies and souls, if you really give yourself with dedication and passion, rapture and humility to the path, let me read you three of his poems of unity. Remember who is speaking. It is you, through him, who are speaking to yourselves. He is the divine self talking to the human self. One day I'd been working on translations in Paris of Rumi, and I walked out by the Seine, and I was wrestling about this question, who is Rumi really? And at that moment, I saw a bird fly up from the water and fly, it seemed, totally directly into the burning setting sun, the sun that was vast and burning and immense. And at a moment, at the very moment, when it would have actually flown into the core of that sun and been annihilated, it suddenly seemed just to stop, to stretch its wings out, and to have its whole body inundated with light, so that all you could see was the outline of the bird, and the body of the bird was light. That is Rumi. He was kept by divine mercy to the world at the very placeless place where his whole being could be lit up with the divine splendor, and yet he could still be kept on the earth, able to tell the secrets of that divine splendor to every other person whose secret it is. I have come to a desert where love appears. Everything impure there has found total purity. What could coral be worth beside the price of the soul? see how a sun appears to an atom. There are thousands of locks, each vast as heaven. A few letters in the shape of a key open them all. My heart is a vast tablet of light, an ocean of agony drowned it again and again, but it became a warrior after being martyred 100 times. I venerate each of the waves of this ocean because I know that I'm at once the feast and the disemboweled victim served up at the feast. And I know that I am the slave of a fish that comes from the sea. And I know that each drop of this sea clothes a form that appears. And I know that each form carries the name of a saint or mystic. O, my soul, enter and purify yourself in this boundless ocean, where one drop engenders 1,000 graces and visions. The swells and storms of destiny imperil every ship, but in this sea of peace, all find safety at last. And this poem, which to my mind is the limits of what can be said, it is a person in superconsciousness, seeing the divine world, tasting the divine in absolutely every event and thing and being and smell, speaking of that rapture. And this is where you and I are going. This is our truth. This is our secret. This is why we are here, to have this experience and then to express it in sacred service of all beings. This entire world is the form of universal reason, which is the father mother of all lovers of the divine word. If you go on being ungrateful towards God, nothing will change. So make your peace with God. Abandon disobedience. And I tell you that this world's clay and water will appear before you like a gold carpet, and resurrection will become your immediate experience, and heaven and earth will be transfigured in your eyes. Since I have become, by divine grace, at peace always with my Father, the world always appears like a paradise to me. And at each moment, a new form and a new beauty appear, and their glory dissolves all fear and all doubt and all timidity and all boredom. I see the world radiant and brimming with magnificence, the waters constantly flowing from the springs of heaven. The sound of these waters is always enchanting my ears, and my deepest mind and consciousness reel with bliss. The branches of the trees dance for me like penitents, and I see leaves everywhere clapping their hands like musicians. The mirrors shining seeps through its velvet. Imagine the blaze when the mirror itself appears. And if you think this experience is astounding, astonishing, overwhelming, glorious beyond all imagination, what you are seeing is just the seeping of the mirror's blaze through its velvet sheath, the 72,000 veils of illusion that creation is. Imagine that day when you, as the lover of the beloved, will be swept up directly into the naked, unimaginable Kybria of the present. Imagine it. Because that experience begins here and ends nowhere. Dhul Noon met a woman on a desert, actually by the beach, He asked her, where does love end? And she started to laugh. She said, love has no end because love is infinite. So there is no end to the expansions that your spirit will make on this astounding journey, even beyond what he can describe now. I want to end with just an anecdote about Rumi himself. Because quite frankly, all of this glory, all of this beauty, all of this passion, all of this astonishment that I've tried to pour out for you and to inflame your hearts with wouldn't be worth an old penny if it hadn't produced a being of the deepest and holiest refinement, courtesy, and humility. Because that is what all of these are for. Llewellyn said it so beautifully that the whole point of the Sufi path is to become a Sufi, which means a lover and a slave. And one of the most astonishing things about Rumi, and one of the things that continually reduces me in my heart to tears about him, is that with all his splendor of mystical achievement, with all this torrent of mystical poetry that had come from him and made him famous all over his world, with all of the rich and famous and celebrated pupils that came to him for illumination, with everything that he must have known about his own election in the face of God, for all of that, Rumi was the humblest of beings. And I think that, to me, is the revelation of what an authentic teacher is. An authentic teacher is the servant of those he or she attempts to illumine. That is what an authentic teacher is. And in that, the Christian and the Sufi revelations meet. The last act of Jesus on this earth was to wash the feet of the disciples. And as you see, Rumi does something very, very similar in this astonishing story. There was a scholar monk from the country around Constantinople who had heard of the knowledge, sweetness, and humility of our master. And full of affection for Rumi, although he was of a different religion, he set out and arrived in Konya looking for him. The monks of Konya went to meet him and received him with honor. He then asked to visit Rumi and met him by chance on the road. The monk prostrated 3 times before him. And when he rose up, he saw that Rumi had prostrated himself also. It is said that he bowed his head 33 times to the monk. Crying out loud and tearing his robe, the monk exclaimed, "O Sultan of religion, how can you take to such an extreme point the humiliation and self-abasement you show me, who am just a miserable wretch full of faults?" And this is what Rumi replied. And until the day I die, I'm going to remember these next 5 lines, because they to me have perfect pitch. They are the perfect balance between grandeur and abasement, total mystical knowledge and total humility, that everyone who is on this path should strive to fuse in their being so that they become, paradoxically, both everything and nothing, and everything because nothing. Rumi replied to this boy who had seen the greatest mystic of his time bow 33 times in the dust. "Happy is he whom God gave wealth, beauty, honor, and power, and who has been generous in his wealth, chaste in his beauty, humble in his honor, and just in his power. This is what our prophet said. So how could I not be humble before the servants of God? And why would I not be honest
and show my own misery and nothingness. If I did not, what would I be useful for?
There are two paradoxes on the path. One is that you're looking for something that you already have. And the second is that when you find it, it doesn't make you a lord, it doesn't make you an emperor, it doesn't make you omnipotent and omniscient in any of the fantastic ways that the ego would like to imagine. What it does make you is an astounded servant of eternal love in the world, a slave of the divine, anxious and passionate to be used at every moment for the working out of the will of God in time. May we all come to know the splendor of the path and the splendor of that radiant nothingness and everything that await for all of us. And may these days be a feast of divine passion, divine love, divine mischief, and divine intensity.
So we spend some time now together in the silence of the heart. Please, if you have a meditation practice or silent prayer that you like to do, feel free to do it. I will explain to you the silent meditation of the heart, which is one way to still the mind and dissolve in love. Because for centuries, Sufis have been sitting together, allowing the heart to take them back to God. And this is the one of the ways to help this mystery of dissolving in love to happen. Because for the Sufis, the heart is king. And we use the energy of love to take us home, to take us to the beyond of the beyond. So a simple way to do this meditation of the heart is to think of somebody you love. It can, of course, be the great beloved. But sometimes the great beloved is a little too abstract. So if you think of somebody whom you love, and this fills your heart with the softness, with the warmth, with passion, with silence, even with sweet sorrow, because love has so many different qualities. And when your heart becomes touched, becomes full of this feeling of love, then you just take the whole of yourself, and you immerse it in this feeling of love within the heart. And when thoughts come, which they will, you just put them back into the feeling of love. And slowly, the love quietens the mind. And slowly, the heart works its silent mystery of love. So friends, for the next half an hour, we sit together in the silence of love.